Okay, good morning, everybody. This is Bible 231, March 23rd, and we're going to finish up the introductory chapter on nervous system, move on to central nervous system today. So let's just think a little bit about what we did last time. All right, so if you're busy studying, that's fine, but don't be too rowdy back there in case some people really want to listen to what I'm saying, all right? So if you're eating noisily, maybe stop eating or go out in the hallway. Or if you're got a real important conversation, just step out in the hallway and come back in, okay? All right, so what are the two basic divisions of the nervous system? You've got, and remember that first slide that I showed you right here, you've got central nervous system and peripheral nervous system. And central nervous system you could break down into brain and spinal cord. And then everything that's outside the brain and spinal cord is what we call the peripheral nervous system. All right, and functionally we can break the peripheral nervous system down into two divisions. One division brings information into the central nervous system. The second division takes it out of the central nervous system out to the periphery. So you should be familiar with those names. So what brings information into the central nervous system? The afferent system, or you could say sensory, right? Sensory. And in the spinal cord, which way are those nerve impulses traveling? From superior to inferior or inferior to superior? Are they going up or down? Which way are they going, up or down? Afferent or sensory is going up to the brain. Those are what we call sensory pathways. All right, the other kind are what we call motor pathways. And the proper term for motor would be efferent, right? So efferent. And in the spinal cord, are those ascending or descending pathways? They're going to be descending. Motor is descending, and then it goes from spinal cord out to the periphery. All right, so that's why we say motor or efferent is CNS to periphery. Sensory is from your periphery into the central nervous system. Furthermore, we can break the motor down into which two divisions? Somatic and autonomic, right? And somatic is voluntary. That goes to skeletal muscle. What other things in your body can you voluntarily control besides skeletal muscle? Is there anything else? There is nothing else. The only thing you have control of in your whole body is just skeletal muscle. Everything else is taken care of via the autonomic nervous system. So furthermore, we can break the autonomic nervous system down into two divisions. Right, and those are the sympathetic and parasympathetic nervous systems. And these go to these various effector organs. Three classes of effector organs: smooth muscle, cardiac muscle, and glands. And that takes care of all the effectors in your body. Skeletal muscle via somatic, and then smooth cardiac muscle, and glands via the autonomic nervous system. All right, so always keep that little architecture, that diagram, in your mind when you're thinking of the nervous system. All right, I think maybe one of the hardest things that we looked at last time had to do a little bit more with electrophysiology when we talked about an action potential and when a nerve cell is at rest, all right, what does it act like? When a nerve cell is at rest, and as a matter of fact, any living cell when it's at rest acts like a battery, right? It separates electrical charge, and there's two kinds of electrical charges. Does anybody know what the two kinds of electrical charges are? Positive and negative, right? And so when you have a cell at rest, this is what you have to know. When you have a cell at rest, let's just draw it on the board right here, right? Where would we want to put negative charges? They're on the inside of the cell, which means then on the outside it is positive. That's right. So this is a cell at rest. All right. Also, a cell at rest, we should be aware of the concentrations of two electrolytes. These are chemical compounds that have electrical charge associated with them. And one is sodium and the other is potassium. So it probably is a good idea that you know the chemical symbol for sodium, which is Na, and the chemical symbol for potassium is K. So you just got to memorize that unless you speak Greek. Okay, then it makes perfect sense. So where is sodium high? Is it outside or inside? It's high outside the cell, so here is Na. Don't forget, it has an electrical charge, and that means potassium is high where? Inside the cell. So this is a cell at rest. But when it's excited and it wants to transmit electrical information, remember that's the job of the nervous system, to transmit information very rapidly over long distances, and neurons can do this electrically by manipulating these electrolytes or charged compounds, all right? That is called an action potential. So a nerve can send information very rapidly long distances via an action potential. What does action mean? Something's happening, right? So the cell is no longer at rest. These ions are moving around, all right? So action potential. And how many phases does an action potential have? It's not bad. There's just two, and you should know their names, all right? What happens first? They go in a certain order. What happens first? Depolarization. That means the battery gets discharged. Depolarization. All right, maybe I'm spelling it pretty close, all right? And then the second phase is repolarization. All right, so those are the two parts of an action potential. And what you have to do in your mind is link the movement of these ions to these two phases of an action potential. All right, and that's where we're going to leave it in this class. So what is depolarization characterized by? Depolarization means that this negative charge on the inside of the cell disappears. How are you going to make this negative charge disappear? We can add something to it. We can add positive charges, right? Because positive and negative attract each other and they cancel each other out. So the first phase, number one, right here, has to do with sodium entering the cell. And when a positive charge enters a cell, it becomes less negative and the battery becomes discharged. Okay, so depolarization is due to the electrolyte sodium. And which way does sodium go? Goes inside. That's all you have to know. Okay, and what's the second phase of an action potential? Repolarization. Repolarization, then potassium leaves. That's the second part. That's repolarization. All right, so potassium, which is also an electrolyte, leaves the cell. And I suppose that makes sense, because when the cell is at rest, what's the charge inside the cell? It's negative. And when a positive charge, leaves, okay, what happens to the inside of the cell? It becomes more negative. It goes back to the resting case, right? When a positive charge leaves the inside of the cell, that leaves what? More negative charges on the inside. And so that recharges up the cell when that happens. It goes back to the resting state, okay? All right, so that's what you have to know about an action potential. Link it up with those electrolytes. Do you know how to spell electrolyte? I don't know, maybe I can. Electrolyte, it's L-Y-T-E, electrolyte. That's any kind of charged compound that's in your body. Like calcium is an electrolyte, sodium, potassium, magnesium, some of those things. Okay, is that me or is that somebody else? That's somebody else making a noise. Okay. So sometimes, maybe you're going to be in an emergent situation, maybe emergency room, and there's a critical patient, and all of a sudden a physician is going to say, we need some lights on this patient right away. What are you going to do if you're in there helping in the emergency room? Are you going to go get a bunch of flashlights or lights and start shining them on the patient? No. What are they talking about? They're talking about drawing some blood really fast, getting it to the lab so the lab can measure the concentrations of what? Sodium and potassium and calcium in the patient, because these are all real important for keeping these cells healthy, right? So when they say they need lights, they need measurements of what? Electrolytes right here. L-Y-T-E, not L-I-G-H-T. Okay, so these are really important things. In physiology, we're really interested in those kinds of things. All right, what's the structural and functional unit of communication between cells called? It's kind of funny when you learn about these things, but it's a synapse, right? It's a synapse, so you know all the different parts of a synapse. There's another electrolyte that is necessary for synaptic transmission besides sodium and potassium, and what is that other electrolyte that's necessary for nerve cells to communicate with each other? That is calcium. Yeah, calcium is necessary for synaptic transmission. All right, so let's move on to some new material. Let's review one more last concept, and that is a nerve impulse is just an action potential in motion moving down an axon. And that action potential can move down an axon in two different ways depending on what happens to the axon in terms of its structure. If a support cell wraps a myelin sheath around an axon, that means that the action potential can hop down the axon, which means that it moves very rapidly, hundreds of times faster than if it is a non-myelinated axon. So how do we talk about those two different ways of transmitting an action potential down an axon? One is slow and one is fast. The fast one is called what kind of conduction? The one that hops is called saltatory, and the one that goes molecule by molecule by molecule is what we call continuous. So if you think of saltatory conduction as being fast, think of maybe running down the stairs or running up the stairs. What would be faster if you were strong enough to run up the stairs to where you only had to step on every third or fourth step, as opposed to having to step on every single step up the way? Which would be faster? If you could skip over steps, right? All right, so saltatory conduction is a lot faster. But if you were to run up the stairs and skip every other step or every third or whatever, you still couldn't do it 100 times faster. But that would be amazing if you could, right? So saltatory conduction is kind of amazing from that standpoint. Okay, let's look. Before we move on to the next item right here, here are some really important definitions that we talked about, right? Gray matter. Gray matter is just composed of nerve cell bodies and dendrites, right? And it means that there's no myelination because myelinated nerve tissue looks white, not gray, right? So white matter usually are axons because that's the only place that is myelinated. So myelinated axons are white matter. Gray matter are just clusters of nerve cell bodies and dendrites someplace. If you have gray matter in the central nervous system, then we're going to call that a nucleus, right? A group of nerve cell bodies deep in the central nervous system. It's going to look gray. We're going to call that a nucleus. However, if it's in the peripheral nervous system, we're going to call it a ganglion, right? So there's some analogous terminology right here between CNS and PNS. Now, if it's white matter, these are myelinated axons. And where can you have myelinated axons? In the central nervous system or peripheral nervous system or both? Well, you can have them in both locations. But if they're in the central nervous system, if it's a myelinated axon or a group of them, then we call it a tract. So a tract you have to associate with central nervous system. But in the peripheral nervous system, what do we call myelinated axons that are going someplace? Then we just call it a nerve. Right, so a nerve and a tract are pretty much the same thing, but a tract is in the CNS and a nerve is in the peripheral nervous system. Okay, nerves are a little bit different because they have a lot of connective tissue that hold the nerve fibers together, and a nerve fiber is just a nerve cell, and they probably have to have their own blood supply. So let's look at the structure of a nerve. All right, so where are you going to find nerves? In the peripheral nervous system, not the central nervous system. So nerves you don't have in brain and spinal cord, you have them out in your periphery. And probably you've bonked these things every once in a while. There's a nerve that goes through your elbow superficially, and it can get compressed on an epicondyle of the humerus and give you a little electrical shock like the ulnar nerve, right? And this is what one of these nerves looks like. And maybe you should think of this nice model in your mind of a muscle. Remember, we could break a muscle down into fascicles and then fascicles down into cells, muscle fibers. Well, we can do the same thing with a nerve. So a nerve is surrounded by connective tissue that holds everything together, and that connective tissue is called the epineurium. And inside the epineurium, we have various bundles. And what's another name for a bundle of something? That's a fascicle, right? So there are nerve fascicles as well as muscle fascicles. And inside these fascicles, then, or the building block of a fascicle, are the individual nerve fibers or nerve cells. And what you see right here are just axons. You don't see any nerve cell bodies or dendrites. These are just axons that are going someplace. So maybe you could think of these as almost as like wires taking information someplace. And the connective tissue that surrounds each fascicle is what we call the perineurium. Right? And inside the fascicle, then, the building block we said is an axon, and these are myelinated axons. What kind of cells form myelin sheaths around nerves in the peripheral nervous system? Schwann cells. Yeah, those are Schwann cells. And what do we call the ones in the central nervous system? Those are what we call oligodendrocytes, right? So these are a little bit different cells, right? But in the peripheral nervous system, they're just Schwann cells. Ooh, does anybody remember what we call this junction between Schwann cells right here, like this little dip? It's called a node. A node of who? Node of Ranvier. That's right. That's a node of Ranvier. And this is where how the electrical signal jumps. It jumps from one node to the next, right? Skipping all that space underneath the Schwann cell. So you can see the myelin sheath. But surrounding every nerve fiber, including the myelin sheath right there, is another connective tissue layer, and we call that the endoneurium. All right, so I'm pretty sure this is a nice exam figure because it shows you the epineurium, right, the perineurium, and the endoneurium surrounding these various building blocks that makes a nerve. And, of course, these are all living structures. They need oxygen and nutrients, and here is the vascular supply for a nerve. All these connective tissue layers and blood vessels we don't find in the central nervous system. Okay? Our brain wouldn't be big enough, really, to hold all of the neurons if it included all this connective tissue and all these blood vessels. It has different kinds of ways of holding the brain together with different kinds of connective tissues and blood vessels. All right, so be aware of how to label this thing right here. All right, let's talk a little bit about some physiology, maybe a reflex. A reflex is just a way that your body can protect itself without conscious thought, right? So it is a reflex will work on skeletal muscle, which usually you have voluntary control of, but sometimes you need to act faster to protect your body, protect it from damage before you actually have time to think about it. So probably all of us at one time or another have grabbed something that was hot, maybe in the kitchen or maybe out on the beach, right? And you pick something up and you start to burn your fingertips. And in order for you to perceive that, in order to understand what's happening, those electrical impulses have to enter your central nervous system. How do they get into your central nervous system? What kind of pathway? A sensory or afferent pathway. That takes a little time to do that, even though nerves are very fast. It still takes a little bit of time for that action potential to get to the central nervous system, to your spinal cord. And what's happening during that time that action potential is moving or nerve impulse is moving into the spinal cord? Well, you're still holding on to that thing that's really hot, right? So you're still damaging your tissues, right? It gets into your spinal cord, and then that action potential has to go up the spinal cord to a certain part of the brain, okay? And what's happening during that time? You're still damaging that part of your body because you don't know what's happening yet. And then there's a part of the brain that tells that signal where to go to the cerebral cortex, right? And then all of a sudden you get an idea, oh, I'm burning my hand, okay? Well, what's happening during that whole time? Your hand is burning, all right? And then your brain has to figure out what to do. It's got to make a decision, and the decision is to what? Let go of the pan or the charcoal grate or whatever, all right? So it makes a decision, but what's happening during that time? You're still burning your hand. And then the signal has to go back down out of the brain into the spinal cord. What's happening during that time? You're still burning your hand. And then it goes out the peripheral nerve to the muscles in your arm, and then you let go. And then finally what happens? You stop burning your hand. Right? So it's a long process. A reflex cuts a lot of that time out. Right? So a reflex is the following. Let's take a look right here. Here's a pretty good example of a reflex. Right, so a reflex always starts with a stimulus, right? And let's use some kind of painful stimulus, like burning, right? Or maybe here you're getting poked with a needle, for instance, and a receptor picks that information up, and it sends information to the central nervous system. Here is just a transverse section of a spinal cord. So what would you call this neuron right here? This is a sensory neuron or an afferent neuron, sensory neuron right here, and it's of a particular kind. You see that is just a unipolar neuron right here, and here's the cell body of it that's really close to the spinal cord. Okay, And so that takes a little time for the signal to get into the central nervous system. But now, instead of going up to the brain, this signal is passed on to an interneuron. And here's the cell body. Here is one long axon. This is just a multipolar neuron. And an interneuron is completely contained within the CNS. There's no part of it that is in the peripheral nervous system. And you can see that that's not the case with this sensory neuron, right? Because here's a sensory neuron. Part of it is in the periphery, and another part is in the central nervous system, right? So it's in both places. All right, so that's why we call this the central process of a unipolar neuron and this the peripheral process of a unipolar neuron. All right, but this interneuron or association neuron takes the signal from the sensory neuron and passes it directly to this neuron right here. And it looks red to me. What are you going to call this red neuron? That's a motor neuron because it's going to go to this skeletal muscle, which is going to act as the effector, and it causes this skeletal muscle to contract. Okay, and so if you're grabbing something hot, it will be the extensor muscles that are going to contract, right, in your posterior forearm, which will extend your fingers and you'll let go of that hot object. All right, so this signal doesn't have to go all the way up to the brain. The brain doesn't have to figure out what's going on. This happens without your conscious thought because your perception does not take place in the spinal cord. Perception is the result of electrical activity in the cerebral cortex, right? Not the spinal cord. So this happens a lot faster, and that protects your body from a lot of damaging exposure to whatever that stimulus is. So a reflex has these parts to it. And remember, this is all happening automatically, even though it requires a skeletal muscle or a voluntary muscle to work. A reflex always starts with a stimulus. You need a receptor, right? If you don't have pain receptors, if they're not functioning, then you can damage your body and you won't even know it. Like when? When would that happen? Hopefully that hasn't happened to you, but it could happen very easily. Like when? When would that take place? Like when you go to the dentist and you get a nerve numbed, right? You lose that sensory reception in your mouth, and you could be, if you had lunch with that nerve anesthetized, you could be eating your tongue or your cheek along with your lunch, right? So that's why dentists say don't eat anything until that anesthesia wears off. So you have stimulus. Always starts a reflex. Then you have to have a receptor that's active. And then you need what? A afferent neuron. And then an interneuron. The interneuron directly stimulates a efferent or motor neuron, which goes to an effector. And then the last thing right here, all right, so there should actually be seven things to a reflex arc right here. What does the effector do? It's going to contract, and that contraction is what we're going to call a response. Okay? So a reflex starts with the stimulus and ends with a response. Oh, and look in our list right here. Ah, nice. We got seven items, right? So you got stimulus, receptor, sensory neuron, integration center, which includes this interneuron right here, then a motor neuron, right? Effector neuron, and then, the motor neuron is the effector neuron, then the effector would be the skeletal muscle, and when the skeletal muscle contracts, that's the response. And what should the response do to the stimulus? It should, if it's a painful or damaging stimulus, it should remove the stimulus from your body, right? So that protects your body. And how does this happen? With your conscious approval and thought? No, automatically, but most importantly, what's the speed? Fast, because that signal doesn't have to go up to the brain. You don't have to think about it, right? So that is something really nice about a reflex. Okay, and there are different kinds of reflexes in the body, but I think we're just going to start right there. Okay, maybe let's look at this one. This is a little bit different. Notice there's no interneuron right here. So this, sometimes we call this a monosynaptic reflex, right? Because there's only one synapse. So when there are sensory organs in this muscle that tell the muscle that it's being stretched without your command, the muscle is stretching, well, then this muscle is going to contract to protect these joints and to protect the muscle itself. So the sensory neuron directly stimulates a motor neuron without an interneuron. This is a monosynaptic reflex, and the muscle contracts, right? The next one right here is just what we call a polysynaptic reflex that we talked about. So here is an interneuron, and the job of this interneuron now is to share information, not only with the motor neuron right here, but also with higher centers in the brain. So this association neuron not only sends information to the motor neuron, but also to neurons that go up to the brain so that you actually do become aware of it. But you become aware of it after this muscle even starts to contract, right? Because the reflex is fast. That's a polysynaptic reflex. Okay, let's look at some neural pathways. What are some neural pathways that are interesting to look at? Okay, we've got three different kinds: diverging, converging, and reverberating circuits. So for instance, let's look at this slide right here. Here we have one neuron, and we can see that it is bifurcating, and in this particular case, it trifurcates, right? This axon splits into three separate axons that can then stimulate three different cells right here. So this is what we call a diverging circuit. Right. A converging circuit, on the other hand, is where input is coming from three different neurons, and all these neurons will excite a single neuron as an output. So this is a converging circuit right here. And a reverberating circuit, we see if we have a series of neurons. So remember, information can only go from dendrite to cell body to axon. So information will start with neuron number one, and then pass to neuron number two, then number three, then number four, just because that's the way signals go. And even across a synapse, information only goes in one direction, not bidirectionally. But then, notice that we have collaterals of these axons that stimulate this neuron on the side, which then has axons going back opposite the direction that the input signal was traveling in, right? So the signal goes back and can re-stimulate cells within this pathway. So what happens, we call this a reverberating circuit, because once we stimulate this first cell, okay, what happens to these cells in the middle right here? They keep becoming stimulated over and over and over and over again. Okay, so that's a reverberating circuit. So sometimes it is important to share information. Okay, for instance, maybe this neuron right here is picking up some kind of damaging stimulus, and that information is going to be shared with different parts of your body. Maybe I pick something hot up with my right hand, right, and the muscles in my right hand are going to be taught to let go of the object, while the muscles in my other arm are also going to grab something and push away. Right, so that information is going to be used to do different things in different parts of the body simultaneously to protect your body. Right, so that would be an example of why you need a diverging circuit, to share important information with various parts of your body. A converging circuit right here is important for integrating information. So maybe let's give you an example. Let's just say this neuron right here is connected to your ear, so you can hear with this one. And this one is connected to your eyes. Okay, and then this one is connected maybe to hearing, but allows you to understand something about vocal communication. All right, so let's think about a fire alarm. Okay, so a fire alarm has what kind of components to it? It's got a really obnoxious sound, right? So what happens if all of a sudden we hear a really obnoxious sound and it almost sounds like a fire alarm, but there's one right there. What else does a fire alarm have? It's got a flashing light. So let's pretend that we hear something, but we don't see that flashing light, right? So now that information is being integrated in this neuron right here, and so maybe we're not going to leave the room because it really doesn't qualify as a fire alarm. But now we hear the sound, we see the flashing light, all right? What do you think this output should be? Let's get our books together and leave the room, right? So now it's the proper kind of information. But now let's add something else to it. Let's just say, let's add some vocal command. So we hear the sound, see the flashing light, and now you hear me saying, oh, you know what, that sounds like a fire alarm, but I know they're just testing the fire alarms right now. It's not a real fire, and I've been told that we shouldn't vacate the building. So now what is this neuron going to do? It's going to make a decision to ignore the fire alarm and just stay right where you are, right? So this converging circuit integrates information up to produce a proper response for you. All right, now what about this reverberating circuit? That's sort of interesting. Anybody have an idea what your body might use a reverberating circuit for? Once it's stimulated, it stays stimulated, okay? For maybe 10 hours or 11 or 12 hours, something like that. And so this kind of circuit right here is important for maintaining a wakeful state. Right? So when you wake up in the morning, this pathway becomes excited, and then it does what? It re-excites itself. And it stays active over the course of a day, and right as night approaches, the circuit fatigues, and you have that sense of being tired, and the reverberating circuit, this electrical activity dies away, and then what happens? You lose consciousness, you fall asleep. Okay, and these neurons then get rejuvenated, and then in the morning when you hear that alarm clock for your 7:30 anatomy lab, you go, ah, all right, I feel that reverberating circuit activated. Let's go do some anatomy. Okay, and now you can do anatomy all day long because this reverberating circuit is working. All right, so those are some important kinds of processing architectures in the brain for what? Sharing information, for integrating information, and for maintaining a wakeful state. All right, so that's pretty good for the introductory chapter of your nervous system. All right, so I'm going to put that away. And now we're going to move on to central nervous system. All right, so that introductory chapter, make sure you know the structure of the different kinds of neurons. Right, you have the bipolar, multipolar, unipolar, and the different kinds of neuroglia, and maybe some functions associated with those. And certainly the functions of the different kinds of neurons, okay, along with these other things that we've been talking about. Okay, central nervous system. In terms of anatomy, we've got central nervous system, okay, we said you can break down into two main areas. What were the two main areas? Brain and spinal cord. But in this chapter, we want to break the brain down into some important subdivisions too, right? And we'll keep the spinal cord all by itself. That will be one of the important areas. Okay, so let's start to look at some of this stuff. The brain stem, okay? So if you have a flower, what's attached to the stem? You got leaves, you got the flower. So the stem is what? Is supporting the whole plant, right? So you could think of the stem, the brain stem, as supporting everything else in the brain. So let's find, let's find a good example of brain. That has everything in it. All right, so you're not going to have to know all of this stuff right now. Okay, the brain stem. All right, so here we have spinal cord. The brain stem is the most inferior part of the brain. It's the one that directly connects to the spinal cord. And where is this spot right here that determines everything below it is the spinal cord and everything above it is the brain? What is this line right here? Where do you have your brain? In your head, in the cranial vault. How does this tissue get into the cranial vault? It goes through a bone, right? What's the bone that it goes through? The occipital bone, right? And what's the name of that hole? That's the foramen magnum. Yeah, very good. So this line right here is really the foramen magnum. Everything below the foramen magnum is the spinal cord. Everything above is the brain. But nonetheless, it's still what? All central nervous system. The first part of the brain right here is what we call the brain stem. Okay, and the brain stem has got these three different parts to it. This first bulge right here is what we call the medulla oblongata. And the second bulge that we see right here is called the pons. And I'm going to tell you some functions of these things, but it's probably not going to make a whole lot of sense until you get a lab, which you're going to start next time. After the practicum, when you can actually do some, look at some brains, right? And then you'll be able to tie this information together. okay? And then the midbrain. So this is all the brain stem. It connects the spinal cord to all the other parts of the brain. Okay, so the job of the medulla oblongata, since it's the lowest part of the brain, it's really the oldest part of the brain. And when organisms first evolved to have any kind of brain, that part of the brain would take care of various kinds of things for the organism automatically, like breathing, regulating blood pressure, regulating heart rate, things like that. So the medulla oblongata is in charge of controlling a lot of things that you don't have to think about, right? Because the earliest organisms couldn't think anyway, but still they had to have a way of regulating their breathing and heart rate and all of that kind of stuff. So there are nuclei inside the medulla. Now, what is a nucleus again? It's a group of nerve cell bodies and dendrites. It's gray matter, right? So it's a special functional node that is gray, that looks gray. It's just a group of nerve cell bodies and dendrites. And some of these nuclei adjust the heart rate. We call that the cardioregulatory center. Some adjust the constriction of blood vessels all over your body. We call that the vasomotor center. As your blood vessels constrict, your blood pressure goes way up. As blood vessels dilate, your blood pressure goes way down. So what's the best, one of the nice ways that your body can control proper blood pressure? Your blood pressure shouldn't be too high or too low. What do you call it if it's too high? Hypertension. If it's too low, it's hypotension. One of the ways that your body regulates blood pressure is by adjusting the size of blood vessels, by adjusting vasoconstriction. That happens in the medulla right here. Okay, breathing, the respiratory center partly is located there. Swallowing, vomiting, coughing, sneezing centers are located in the medulla. Okay, the pons right here is a relay center for signals having to do with muscle contraction and motor activity of skeletal muscles. And the pons take signals from the higher centers in the brain or signals coming up the spinal cord and shares these signals with the cerebellum. So here is the cerebellum right here. The job of the pons is to share signals with the cerebellum. We're going to talk about the cerebellum in just a little bit. And you can't see the connection because it's wrapping around behind this part of the brain. It's kind of just wrapping around. And what you're looking at in this diagram is the pons over here, but you don't see these pathways that are deep inside the figure, right? So it's wrapping around laterally into the cerebellum. So we say that it is a relay center. It's relaying information from the brain and spinal cord into the cerebellum. And one of the jobs of the cerebellum is to make you walk and act coordinated, right? So it's taking care of all the muscles and bones in your body so that they're working properly. Okay, the midbrain is on top of the pons. So here is the midbrain right here. And, there's one last thing that I want to talk about, I talk about it after midbrain, but maybe now is a good time to talk about it, I think. The reticular formation. All right, the reticular formation is something that is contained within the pons and the medulla. And not the midbrain right here, but the pons and medulla. And it contains a reverberating circuit. What did we say a reverberating circuit was good for? Once it's stimulated, it stays active for a relatively long period of time, like maybe 10 hours or 12 hours. It maintains a wakeful state. So the reticular formation is in the pons and the medulla, and these areas here allow you to stay awake. Now, some people, no matter how hard they try, they just fall asleep during the day. Does anybody know what that condition is called? That's called narcolepsy, right? So now you know what part of the brain has some kind of lesion or damage to it when somebody has narcolepsy. What is that? What's the particular area? What is that particular area called? The reticular formation, and where is the reticular formation located? What part of the brain? It's in the medulla and the pons, both of these structures right here. So it's not a structure, but some structures of the brain share activity to form the reticular formation. Okay, so if somebody has maybe a stroke in that area or some kind of lesion, maybe cancer or some other kind of abnormality in that region, they just fall asleep. And it's really a hard diagnosis to find out exactly why somebody has narcolepsy. And if you can't find out why somebody has narcolepsy, what is really difficult then? You can't treat it, right? And so it's really unfortunate when that happens, okay? So when you have narcolepsy, what happens to your driver's license? It gets yanked because you can't be driving on the freeway falling asleep. You can't be given a lecture falling asleep, that kinds of thing. And there are some sheep that have a really strange reticular formation. When they hear a loud sound, it puts them into a coma. And you could do a little, we don't have time to do this, maybe next time I'll remember to get it queued up on YouTube, and you can see the sheep, as somebody walks in and yells, the whole herd just kind of falls asleep as a result, okay? It is sort of funny, because they don't get hurt. Okay, so remember that reticular formation, and what kind of circuit is necessary? It has to be activated, a reverberating circuit, right? Okay, all right, so let's move on to the midbrain. The midbrain has got a couple of components to it. I see these two little bumps right here. And this is just on one side of the brain. There are two bumps on the right, there are two bumps on the left. So if you count up all the bumps, how many bumps are there? There's four, okay? And so the number for four is what? Quadra, right? Like the quadriceps has four individual muscles in your thigh, your anterior thigh. And so sometimes we call these the corpora quadrigemina, or four little bodies. They're part of the midbrain. And each one is a colliculus. So here is the superior, what? Colliculus. Here is the inferior colliculus. So if you put both superior and both inferior colliculi, colliculi is plural, then you get the corpora quadrigemina. Okay, and these are important for processing sensory information. And the superior two, right here, these are for vision, and the inferior two right here are for hearing. So let's talk about the hearing first, due to the inferior colliculus. So how many doors do you see in this room? I see four, right? And with your eyes closed, and somebody were to walk in, open and close one of those doors, even with your eyes closed, could you tell what door was opening and closing? Yes, if your inferior colliculi are working properly. Because sound will go to one ear, will arrive at one ear before the other, right? So if this door opens up first, it's going to arrive at this ear before this one, and the inferior colliculus can tell what that difference in time is, and then it's going to say, oh, sound is coming from your right. Or if sound is coming first from your left, and you know sound is coming from the left, and even you can have a sense of what's in front of you and back of you as well. So that can be a little bit more difficult. So the inferior colliculus is for localizing sound, finding out what direction sound is coming from, right? And so that's pretty important, because if you hear a really loud, obnoxious sound, like something is exploding, it's a good idea to know where that's coming from, right? So you can get out of the way. So it has important significance for you. The superior colliculus right here is for vision. It allows your eyes or your perception to lock onto an object and then be able to track it in space and then figure out where it's actually going to arrive. And that's important because if there's a fast-moving object, you would like to know really fast if that object is moving right at you or away from you, right? And if it's moving right at you, what are you going to do? Well, then you're going to duck, right? Unless you're a baseball player, what are you going to do? You see this baseball taking off in the air real fast, and all of a sudden it starts curving. And it's the superior colliculus that can lock onto that ball and just look at a little bit of the path of that ball and figure out where it's going to land by calculating the curvature and all that kind of stuff, right? So the superior colliculus is important for visual tracking, all right? So baseball players, right, get paid millions of dollars just because they have this superior colliculus, right? They have one that is really nice. They can track things in space very, very nicely. All right, so the corpora quadrigemina, part of the midbrain, and then this area right here is just a bridge. It's a bridge between the brain stem and spinal cord and higher centers in the brain. And so this right here we call a peduncle. You probably haven't heard that word before. So a peduncle is just a bridge, a major big bridge that carries information from one part of the brain to another. That's a peduncle. And as a matter of fact, we said, what was the job of the pons again? It was to share information with the cerebellum. And there are connections between the pons and the cerebellum, which are lateral, so we can't really see them right here. They're called peduncles as well, because there's a bridge from the pons into the cerebellum. Those are peduncles. Here is what we call the cerebral peduncle, because it takes information up to the cerebrum. But these peduncles between the pons and the cerebellum are what we call the cerebellar peduncles, because it takes information into the cerebellum. Okay, so a peduncle, just think of as a bridge. All right, so that's the first part of the brain. The next part of the brain is this area right here. It sits on top of the brain stem, and we call that the diencephalon. So let's look at the diencephalon. Diencephalon has got two parts. One part right here is what we call the thalamus. It's probably about as big as a walnut, and it's got two lobes, just like a walnut does. And there's a connection between the two lobes right here that we call the interthalamic adhesion, or intermediate mass of the thalamus. And the job of the thalamus is to take sensory signals that are coming up the spinal cord that have moved through the reticular activating system. Oh, what does the reticular activating system have? What state does it have to be in order to allow signals up into the thalamus right here? It's got to be awake, right? So it can act like a filter. It can suppress signals when you're in a sleep state, right? They won't even reach the thalamus right here. But if you're in a wakeful state, that information comes up here. And then the job of the thalamus is to pass that information on to the correct part of the cerebral cortex. And what part of the cortex is an organ? Is it the deep part or superficial part? It's the superficial part. So the thalamus then sends signals to the surface of the brain for your perception, so your awareness of those different modalities of energy. Okay? So, for instance, the visual center is in the occipital lobe over here. You hear with the temporal lobe. Your perception of sound is in the temporal lobe, and so it's the job of the thalamus to take those signals and present it to the proper lobe of the brain. So it acts like a relay center, just like the pons does, but just in a little bit different sense. It's not for equilibrium, but it's for sensation. So there is the thalamus right here. And then below the thalamus, we have something that we call the hypothalamus, right? So the location is in its name. Hypo just means below. So if you can see this oval structure right here is the thalamus. Here is the hypothalamus. And the hypothalamus has some pretty interesting effects, okay? And the hypothalamus regulates your body temperature. And is that a good idea to have your body temperature regulated? Yeah, because if you were to take your body temperature, what would it be? Most of the time it would be 98.6, right? Whether it was 0 degrees outside or 90 degrees inside or outside, you'd still be at that temperature. Okay, so the thermoregulatory center is in the hypothalamus. You also have a center right here that can look at the salt concentration in your blood. And as the salt concentration increases in your blood, that means that your blood is a little bit low on water, you're going to have a sensation of thirst, right? To drink water, to bring the salt concentration back down, right? So your thirst center is in the hypothalamus. And there's also a hunger center in the hypothalamus. When you're low on calories, it will give you the sensation that you are hungry. And even more importantly, probably, the hypothalamus controls a very important endocrine gland right here that is found in the sella turcica of the sphenoid bone. And I think we looked at this already. This is the pituitary gland, right? So we talked about the control of the hypothalamus over the pituitary. Here's the anterior and here's the posterior pituitary through those two different mechanisms. One is via hormones to the anterior pituitary, and the posterior pituitary just releases hormones that are synthesized directly in the hypothalamus right here. All right, and here's the pituitary stalk. Now, what did we call a bridge between major parts of the brain, like between the brain stem and the cerebrum right here? A peduncle. So here's the cerebral peduncle. Or the bridge between the pons and the cerebellum. That's a peduncle, but it's the cerebellar peduncle. Okay. Now here is, and it's never called this, but I just want to kind of misname it a little bit, just number one for fun, but number two to help you understand what a peduncle is. Here is a bridge between the hypothalamus and the pituitary. What did we call a what did we call a bridge before? A peduncle, right? So, but we call that what, the infundibulum or stalk, pituitary stalk in real anatomy. But you could also call it a peduncle, right? Because it's connecting the hypothalamus and the pituitary. But what kind of peduncle is it? It's a really little peduncle, right? So you could call that a pedunculito if you wanted to. Okay, the pituitary stalk right there. Okay. All right, so that's the diencephalon. So it controls the pituitary and controls, helps control a lot of autonomic functions in your body. All right, now that takes us to the cerebrum, which is the largest part of the brain right here. And if you look at the surface, what is the surface called of an organ? The cortex, right? So if you look at the cerebral cortex, does it look smooth and flat or does it look all wrinkled up? It looks all wrinkled up, okay? And when you have wrinkles on something or folds, we call that a convolution, all right? So the surface of the brain is convoluted. There are ridges, there are high points, and then there are depressions, and then depressions are followed by what? More high points. And so a convolution has got two parts to it. The high point that we see right here, that's what we call a gyrus, and a depression is what we call a sulcus. And a sulcus, you've heard already from our bone anatomy, right? A sulcus is just a depression, but it's what? Like an elongated sulcus. Another name for a sulcus is a groove. But typically in neuroanatomy, we don't call these grooves. We call them a sulcus. Okay? And the cerebrum has different lobes. Right? So this lobe over here, what would you call this lobe? That would be, it's named after the bone that it's by. What bone is that? Occipital, right? So here's the occipital lobe. And over here, what bone is this by? The frontal bone. So that's the frontal lobe. And then right here, this is the parietal lobe because it's associated with the parietal bone. Now what we can't see is, well, we can see just a little bit of it over here, but way lateral, there's another lobe that is just on the other side of the temporal bone. So this is the temporal lobe right here. So those are the major lobes of the brain, occipital, parietal, frontal, and temporal. And you have some different views in your book. Okay. So let's talk about some of the functions of these different lobes right here. And I think you have actually a really good picture of functions in your book. Okay, this is pretty good. All right, so here's a lateral view. All right, so here we got spinal cord, here we got medulla. What would you find right in between these, the medulla and spinal cord? The foramen magnum, right? Okay, so here is the medulla, then the pons. Remember, the pons' job is to, one of the jobs is to send information into the cerebellum, and I can see a little bit of a cerebellar peduncle right here. All right, but we're interested now with the cerebrum. So here we see the temporal lobe. Here's the occipital lobe. Here's the parietal lobe right here. And all of this is the frontal lobe. And this sulcus separates the parietal lobe from the frontal lobe. And we call this the central sulcus. And it goes all the way from the top of the brain down to this separation right from the temporal lobe. Here we see, we call this the lateral sulcus. This is the central sulcus. So the central sulcus separates the frontal lobe from the parietal lobe. And there, if this is a sulcus, what do we call this first ridge? That's a gyrus, right? The ridge in the surface of the brain is a gyrus. And we call this one the precentral gyrus. Because where do you find it? It is anterior to the central sulcus. So pre means what? In front of the central sulcus, and this is the first gyrus. That's a pretty important gyrus. Just like this one over here is a pretty important gyrus. Right? But it's not the precentral gyrus. We call this the postcentral gyrus. Oh, did I pass the sign-in sheet around? I forgot to do that. Uh-oh, let's do it really fast. Okay. Pass it around. Okay, postcentral gyrus. So what lobe of the brain is the postcentral gyrus in? Parietal. What lobe of the brain is the precentral gyrus in? The frontal lobe. Okay. And so let's start talking about the frontal lobe right here. The frontal lobe will initiate motor activity of skeletal muscles. And what kind of control are skeletal muscles under? Voluntary control, right? So it develops, muscles contract due to your conscious thought. And this right here is the area that undergoes electrical activity, depolarizations, and action potentials start right here in the precentral gyrus. And that starts motor activity in your body from skeletal muscles. So we call this the primary motor cortex because it controls your skeletal muscle. So if you get a stroke in this part of the brain or some kind of lesion like a tumor, what's going to be the deficit that you have to live with? You lose control over that part of your body. You can no longer control those skeletal muscles. Okay. All right. So that's important. Skeletal muscle. Okay. There is an area, I want to show you this area. There's another area anterior to the precentral gyrus that is very special for speech. So it controls very special muscles that you use for articulation. We call that Broca's area. I got to find that area. Here it is. All right, so here is the precentral, here's the postcentral gyrus, and right, just a little bit anterior to the precentral gyrus is Broca's area. So if you have a lesion in this part of your brain, okay, you'll be able to move normally, but you won't be able to sound words out. You won't be able to speak as a result. But can you hear? Can you hear and understand language if you only have a lesion in Broca's area? Yes, right? That's what's kind of interesting because sensory information goes to a different part of the brain. We're going to talk about those different parts in a little bit. Okay? The prefrontal cortex, way up here in the frontal lobe, we call this area for cognition and also understanding appropriate behavior and instituting appropriate behavior depending on your social circumstance that you find yourself in. Okay? And this is one of the last areas of the brain to develop. Doesn't really develop completely until you're about 23 years of age. All right? So what kind of individuals get into a lot of trouble and they really don't care? Like teenagers, people in high school, right? Because this part of the brain really hasn't developed yet, right? But nonetheless, we have to teach these people proper things, okay? Okay, so that's in the prefrontal cortex right here. So what am I missing? Oh, also in the frontal lobe, there are things called the basal ganglia. But that's kind of a misnomer because today we should call it a nucleus, the basal nuclei. And the basal nuclei, I'll show you probably in the next lecture where they're located, but they're important for inhibiting skeletal muscles so that you have nice fluid motion. So for instance, in order to control your fingertip, can you tell me what two muscles am I operating right now so that I have proper control of my fingertip? I'm contracting my biceps, but what else is happening? I'm relaxing the triceps, right? And so it's the job of the basal nuclei to not only control how much the biceps is contracting, but how much the triceps is relaxing. So what happens if I contract my biceps, but the basal nuclei don't tell the triceps to relax? Right? Then I'm fighting myself, and my motion is very, not exaggerated, but it's kind of jagged. Right, it's very hard to control. There's a lot of tremor. And so people that have damage to the basal nuclei have tonic contractions of skeletal muscle all over their body. They have difficulty moving. Okay, and that's called Parkinson's disease. So Parkinson's disease is a lesion in the basal nuclei that makes movement very, very difficult for them due to skeletal muscle movement. Okay, so for the frontal lobe, I want you to know that that primarily is the motor cortex. And how are you going to remember that? What's an easy way for you to remember that the primary motor cortex is in the frontal lobe? Because in your car, where do you have your motor? In the front, okay? But who has a motor in the back? Anybody have a motor in the back? I'm sorry if you do, Okay, that's okay. But now, does anybody have a motor like right smack in the middle of your car? If you have a car with a motor right smack in the middle, I want to borrow your keys. Because those are really fancy cars. Really, really, really super fancy cars. You could talk to me about that sometime. But that's not really anatomy. Most of us have motors in the front, right? And that's where we have the cortex for motor activity in our body. All right, what's another lobe? How about parietal lobe? If the frontal lobe is important for motor, then you could probably guess that the parietal lobe is important not for motor, but for other things. Like what? For sensation. Remember, we could break the peripheral nervous system down into two functional areas, motor and sensory. Okay? So central nervous system, the cerebral cortex, the same. Motor is the frontal, and the parietal lobe is for primary sensation. And the most important gyrus for sensation, at least on the surface of your body, is the postcentral gyrus right here. So if you have a lesion in the postcentral gyrus, will you be able to move properly if the lesion is only in the postcentral gyrus? Can you control your body properly? Yes, because the precentral gyrus is completely happy and healthy. It can control your body. But what is the deficit that you are experiencing? Now you're losing sensation in some part of your body, okay, when there is a lesion in the postcentral gyrus. So you won't feel temperature or pain in whatever area of the brain that has been damaged. So we call this the primary somatosensory cortex. Somato means what? On the surface of your body, having to do with things not in body cavities, like where skeletal muscles are. Skeletal muscles are not in body cavities, right? So somatic as opposed to visceral, which are things inside body cavities, like the abdominal cavity or pelvic cavity. Okay? And as a matter of fact, everything posterior to the central sulcus more or less is involved in sensation. Right? The surface of your body is represented by the postcentral gyrus. The occipital lobe is sensation, but a very special kind of sensation. It is the cortex for vision. Right, and it requires a lot of processing and a lot of brain power to see things and understand shape and color and all that kind of stuff. Yeah. The frontal lobe is the motor cortex. Parietal lobe is for sensation on the surface of your body. It's a sensory cortex, but not for all senses. Okay, for senses basically on the surface of your body. Other senses like vision, that's a very important sense, right? That is the occipital lobe right here. Okay? And then the primary cortex for hearing is the temporal lobe right here. So different cortices have different functions. All right, so the parietal lobe, primary sensory cortex for touch, pressure, pain, right, on the surface of your body. Temporal lobe has the primary auditory cortex and a part of the olfactory cortex, right? And what's the sense of olfaction? Smell, right? Okay, so if there is a lesion in the temporal lobe, what will happen? Will you lose control over your body or sensation? It's going to be sensation, but is it going to be vision or sensation on the surface of your body or what? It'll be the sense of smell, okay, and hearing. It could be hearing, could produce a hearing loss. Okay. Occipital lobe, we said were visual areas. And there's a special area that's kind of between the central sulcus and the visual cortex and the primary auditory cortex right here. And we call this Wernicke's area. And this is very important for speech, comprehension. Because when you understand language, okay, how do you appreciate language? What kind of modalities do you understand when somebody is communicating to you? Certainly you use your ears, but what else do you use? You certainly use your eyes to look at facial expression, right? That is all important forms of communication. All of these signals arrive right here. They converge right in this area for you to understand a spoken language, right? And maybe even written language to some extent too, because of course for written language you need a good visual cortex as well. Okay, so Wernicke's area is the counterpart to Broca's area. Broca's area is what, the motor area, because that's in the frontal lobe. but Wernicke's area is more sensory, is involved with sensation and understanding of language, right? And that is posterior to the central sulcus right here. All right, so that's a little bit of an introduction to central nervous system. Okay, let me see if I can find these basal nuclei for you. We have a couple places where we can find them. I think I see them right in here. All right, so here we have the cerebral cortex, and it is gray matter, right? So you see gray matter. What makes up gray matter? Nerve cell bodies and dendrites, right? So there are no axons, really. They're just, these are special processing centers where you have nerve cell bodies and dendrites. And then deep to the gray matter, you have white matter. And what do we have in white matter? Axons, myelinated axons, right? So they look white. Okay, so I see a lot of white matter in the brain, deep to the gray matter. But every once in a while, we see some areas deep inside the brain that are gray as well. And these are special processing centers for various kinds of functions. And these right here are the basal nuclei. That's the modern day term. Your book still uses some older language. It calls them a ganglia. But officially, a ganglia is located in the peripheral nervous system, not central nervous system. So you should probably just call these things basal nuclei right here. And I don't think I'm going to have you know which one is which, but these are involved with what? Controlling motor activity, skeletal muscles, so that you have nice fluid motion as you walk around or write or whatever. And when these areas get damaged, then you lose that fluid motion. You become very stiff and rigid. That's a characteristic of Parkinson's disease due to damage of these areas right here. That damage can be produced by trauma to the head, like if you're in a motorcycle accident or a car accident and you receive trauma. But there is one sports activity, right, in the world that produces a lot of head trauma. And some of these athletes end up with a trauma-induced kind of Parkinson's disease. What sport is that? Like boxing, where you have these big, powerful guys, right, just slamming each other as hard as they can in the head. And a good example of that would be Muhammad Ali. Got hit in the head a number of times, and it damaged the basal nuclei right here. And he has that severe motor deficit. He has trouble speaking, trouble walking. And if you look at him or listen to him speak, because other muscles can't relax when he's contracting the antagonistic muscle, you get the impression of what when you watch him or listen to him? That he's actually intoxicated, right? Maybe inebriated on alcohol or something. But is that the case? That is not the case, right? He's not a drug seeker. He's not an alcoholic. He has that presentation because of Parkinson's disease, right? So when you're in a clinical setting and you run into a patient, right, and they have your first impression is, oh, maybe that's an alcoholic or somebody that is using drugs inappropriately, right? You got to be really careful and don't treat them like a drug seeker or treat them really bad, him or her bad, because it could just be an organic problem of the basal nuclei that is giving them Parkinson's disease, right? So don't ever insult somebody or hurt somebody's feelings that way. Okay, so next time when we come back, we're going to start with cerebellum right here. No, we're going to start with these fibers. Sorry, we got to talk about white matter. We'll start talking about white matter.